And good evening. It is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston. And tonight, we're blessed again by having Jeff Brown back with us. And Jeff is the author of Soul Shaping. It has been republished again as Soul Shaping, A Journey of Self-Creation. And we're going to talk all about what it means to be a soul shaper and a little bit about, you know, the changes that are going on. So welcome, Jeff.
Hey, great to be here, Lori.
Mm-hmm. It is. So let's talk a little bit about your new book being republished, and you wrote a new preface to it, and you had, I guess, a lot of journey in rewriting this, or rewriting some of it.
Yeah. Well, the journey from, like, you know, I saw it self-published the book at the end of 07, and a lot of things happened very quickly with it. There was a very strong grassroots response to it, and I think about five or six months later, it became obvious to me that I couldn't do the book justice by being a self-published author. So I made contact with a distributor who runs Ingram, named Mark Ouimet, and he recommended the book to some publishers. And very quickly, I did a deal with North Atlantic Books to get the book ready for republishing for this summer. I mean, it takes usually about a year to get everything organized. And so August 25th, 09, it's in bookstores, distributed by Random House. And but, the journey from that point to this point was pretty intense journey. You know, I really had this deluded belief that I was going to finish the book and then I wouldn't have to do much after that. And of course, you know, a different kind of hard work began, which was just beginning to market it and move it into the world, and now starting to sort of take care of itself. But what's really happening more is that I'm spending a lot more time interacting with people who've read the book and been impacted by it. And so, you know, the journey, it's changed a lot. But when we started to work this spring on getting the book ready to be published by North Atlantic, I decided to write a preface, really sort of going over some of the things, the grassroots things that had happened. You know, it takes a village to raise a book, to bring it from the initial stage to this moment in time. And I really had a chance to reflect on some of the things that this journey has sort of validated for me. And one of the things that it's validated is really that this idea of self-admission, you know, so often when I was writing the book, I felt as though nobody would want to read my very private journey, you know, my very subjective. I mean, I'm not a famous person, so, you know, and I had a lot of the voices of shame and self-doubt move through me throughout the writing process, and they were a constant companion. And it's so interesting, I'm Little Missy, that voice inside of me that keeps pushing me, kept telling me to just trust that, you know, this book was for someone other than me. It didn't have to be for someone other than me. It was enough that it was for me, but I kept going, and, you know, the response that I've had to the subjective nature of the book has really been the strongest thing they responded to, readers. Mm-hmm. And really what it's done is that it, for some reason, in the way that it was channeled or written, it really ignites their own self-admission, you know. Suddenly all these things that seem so shameful and unpleasant to admit to ourselves and to others, the door opens to self-revealing. And so many of the emails that I get, a steady flow from others, really are talking about opening the door to their own self-admission and acknowledging the things that have interfered with their path along the way. Mm-hmm. And that's fantastic. So that forms some part of the preface. I had an opportunity to talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it really, I mean, anybody who does read the book, you do tend to put yourself in similar situations. Obviously, they're not going to be exactly the same, but there's certain elements and bits of your story that, you know, kind of weave through other people's lives, because that's, you know, the same, the way that you wrote it from your heart, the way that you wrote it in a way that, you know, really speaks to people, because it's definitely, you know, it's not a hard read. It's not, but you're so truthful and so honest, and you know, everything you're doing is about, you know, helping people come to that authenticity.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to think everything starts with truth. You know, truth is my gateway to the moment. And I tried to write as best I could from that place. And, you know, when I grew up, you know, like so many trauma survivors, you really believe that your family scene, your, the trip inside of that house is so different from your neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I was a student, I used to door knock. I would like knock on the door and go to these like subdivisions. People had homes, you know, we had lost a house and lived in many places. And so I always felt very peripheral. And so I would like knock on the door and I would like step back. It was very symbolic and interesting from that door. You know, like I wasn't really allowed to get too close to that normal scene in that house. And this was my projection, you know. And what's happened with this book is the response has been so much that I wrote other people's story, and that, you know, like the exact contours of my suffering weren't the same, the particular decision maybe to go into law and leave law, all that. But really on the broader or deeper level that, you know, we're all walking fundamentally the same path. We have similar challenges, similar longing for true path, and, you know, and to some degree, similar suffering. You know, we're all the same stage of the collective unconscious, and we work from that place. And now I really understand, like I kind of witness the little guy knocking on the door, stepping back, understanding that he was really off in terms of his understanding of things, and that really whatever was going on inside of that house really wasn't so different from what was going on inside of mine. And that we really are all in this together. It's not just a cliche. I mean, it's really, it's really deeply true.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point about, you know, we are on this, you know, evolution sort of at the same time, or this consciousness at the same time. So I guess that's really what you're saying, is that, you know, as we're all stepping on this consciousness of at the same place and at the same time, it's allowing us to make all of those connections and the weaving of our own story, and that's why we understand so many of the stories that are out there.
Yeah, and you know, I think if we could really connect from this place, which is like, okay, you know, I just had, you know, an example, you know, I just had a personal love connection experience. You could have this experience and say, wow, I really opened my heart. My whole heart opened super wide, and in that really open place, I felt this degree of vulnerability that was so uncomfortable, so difficult to hold in my daily waking consciousness, in my urban life, with all that white noise around me, you know, whatever. And, you know, if we could talk to each other from that place, and then the response might be, wow, you know, I just went on this retreat, and wow, it was so fantastic to have a glimpse of a more unified self. But then I came back to urban life, and whoa, it's like it was painful reentry trauma, you know? And really understand that we're coming from the same place, that whatever I'm doing in that love experience, that person is doing or attempting in that workshop, and that we're all kind of confronted with the limitations of the stage of the collective unconscious together. And to that extent, we really are in this together, you know?
Yeah.
We're wanting more. We're wanting to open deeper. We're wanting to get more authentic, but we're living in a culture that's vibrating on survivalism. I mean, look what happened last fall, you know, economic calamity or some form of calamity. And then we're all gripping at the root, terrified to spend our money, terrified to participate in the world again. I mean, we really are impacted on by many of the same things at the same time.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It is really a fascinating time, and it, you know, I guess that's the important part to get of this, is that, you know, we've got to stop thinking that we're doing this all alone, and, you know, connect with people and, you know, see that, you know, we can all change this if we're all, you know, in that unified place where we can make the difference.
Yeah. And what's, you know, what can we do alone anyway? I mean, you know, most experiences that I wrote about in Soul Shaping were on some level or other relational, whether I was interfacing with some archetypal aspect of myself, which is really an archetypal aspect of the collective, you know, whether I was interfacing with Ram Dass or with a love connection that helped me to become aware of a pattern that wasn't serving me, you know. I mean, every step along the way was a relational step, you know.
Yeah.
There was very little in the way of complete solitude, you know. And even in those most solitary times when I had a lot of solitude, I was really still then trying to heal and interface with my trauma material, with emotional events and experiences that required resolution, still dealing with relational material, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Solitude. I don't think that's on your new, that must have been just in the book, was it? I love how you come up with very unique new terms for,
yeah,
for what we're going through.
I'm mad with that. I'm going to do a 150-page soul-shaping dictionary soon. I have a new one, Western Consciousness. I just added that to the dictionary. It's a bit cheesy. I'm not entirely sure about it yet, but I'm going to leave it there for a while.
So that's what we're going to talk about tonight. We're going to talk about, you know, what it means to be a soul shaper, and it's all your unique, your unique definitions of,
yeah,
of words.
Yeah.
Where shall we start?
Well, we can start with, I know you have a copy of it.
I do.
Yeah, we can talk about some of the,
okay,
the criterion or the ideas. I mean, what had happened for me was I just wrote the book, and then at the end of it, it was like, okay, it's very obvious that I need to create a dictionary of language.
Yes.
Is that your cat?
No.
No, okay. and then as this has developed, it has become a little bit, and you see it a bit on Facebook, a little bit of a mini movement,
yeah,
around some of these ideas. So it became clear to me over the winter that I really needed to try to delineate what I was talking about. You know, like, well, you know, what do I stand for and what don't I fully identify with? And so I started to put them to paper. I was dialoguing with Ram Dass and Maui, and I was really kind of trying to clear through some of the things I was still stuck around, like ego soul stuff and how to differentiate the two and all that. And so we came up with this, and I don't know, do you want to just go through them?
Well, yeah, let's do that.
Okay.
I do definitely want to talk about the ego and the soul, because I think that's, you know, something everybody seems to struggle with. But,
yeah.
Okay, let's, you know, do we want to start at the beginning? Or,
sure.
Yeah, so meaning-driven.
I'll just read it. The soul shaper believes in something more than the arbitrariness of the universe. Life has directionality and purpose. The universe is inherently benevolent. The key is to uncover the meaning that threads through our existence. So this, for me, was really a response to, you know, it's like that whole thank God it's Friday attitude, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like arbitrariness, which I think really is sourced in a discouraged or hopeless or negative lens. And, you know, I didn't have that lens, despite all the things that I had to overcome. And my journey was really sourced in some belief that I was going to get somewhere.
Right.
And that it was a good place to get to, and that I was supported in that, not obviously supported in that, and it certainly didn't feel like that all the time. But just this idea that we come into this, and it kind of links into the second criterion, which is the idea that we all have a true path that's encoded inside of us. And so really it was just coming to this belief and putting it towards this idea that we come into this lifetime with a particular set of soul scriptures that are encoded in us,
mm-hmm,
you know? And that we come into this lifetime to identify them, which is hard enough, and to actualize them in the hope that we can expand our cellular consciousness. We can take ourselves a little bit farther along the spiritual path, not all the way, but some part of the way. And, you know, and to sort of juxtapose this perception, this idea, up against something that we might call false path, something I call false path as a young person, this idea. And that's just sort of misguided action or acting out something habitually and not really moving through it to get through to the next place and not converting it into the lesson that it inherently contains. And so that's the beginning of the definition.
And I think, you know, most people tend to follow the false path because we're not really taught anywhere how to, you know, to weave it together. We're not shown that these threads have meaning and that, you know, we really are, you know, we're really here for a reason, and there's so much depth to the experiences we have, and you know, we have to have the trust and the faith that everything is happening with divine meaning or meaning driven.
Yeah, I mean, I make a distinction between sort of, you know, misguided action, things that happen in the world that are really symbolic or indicative of the idea that the actor is not coming from true path, is off path or false path, or not coming from a benevolent place in their intentionality. You know, I don't think that there's something wonderfully valuable to be learned from every horrible experience.
Yeah.
But I think there are from a lot of them. And it really is very important to try to, like, in our experiences, to differentiate between, you know, forward-moving challenges, you know, things that appear to be false path, but if we work them through, really prove to be true path. I mean, my whole childhood for so long felt like, I mean, how, you know, what a horrible, horrible curse to be handed this family scene, you know. It took a long, long time to really fully believe that it had been a gift. Like, believe it, not just talk it, not just hype talk it, but really, really mean it. And, you know, we got it to get to that place, to differentiate the two. Sometimes you really just have to get to work. And that's the third criterion. I don't know if criterion is the right term for it, but the third aspect of what it means to be a soul shaper is what I call divine perspiration. And really, there's this idea that we this is hard work. You know, there are people out there who will tell us that we just have to ask for what we want. It's coming. And that's not been my experience. I mean, I think if you do enough prep work, the universal broadcasting system starts working with you. You know, they start coming to you. They start feeding you things that will take you to the next place. They really are attuned to your cellular state, you know. But I think to get to that place, you really got to work hard to clear your emotional debris, to convert your experiences into the lessons they inherently contain, you know, to really try to track your soul's journey in a real way. And, I mean, that's not easy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just that we're not taught it in school. It's not just that we're taught geography but not inner geography.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just that we're taught history but not cellular history, you know. I mean, it's all misguided at the school level, but it still is that the culture is gripping at the root of the collective unconscious is still affixed to survivalist constructs. And so really, if you want to do this work, you know, you're trying to go a little bit beyond, I think, the stage of the world around you. So it's hard work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not going to be handed to you on a cellular platter. I mean, that's just bad. But
it is.
It's bad. I'm out of control. But you've got to get to work. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, there's so many times where you think, okay, I think, I'm there. You know, it's going to get easier from here. And it's like, okay, stop. There's got to be a point, though. You know, I'm still waiting for it, but I'm sure there's going to be a point at some point where it gets a lot easier, right?
Often. I don't know. I think for me, my goal was more to feel more authentic, more real, you know? I really didn't have an idea in my mind and that it was going to become seamless, that life was going to become perfectly seamless and flowing and blissed out. I mean, I don't know that I was going for that, you know, the bliss trip. I was really going to try to reach a stage in my consciousness where I had more comfort in my own skin, where I felt kind of more true to soul shape, where I was like doing what I was supposed to be doing on the planet, you know, where I wasn't feeling that confusion and discomfort, like, why am I in this relationship or why am I in this courtroom? There's somewhere else I'm supposed to be, you know? Just to feel like, yeah, I woke up in the morning, and I wake up now in the morning feeling like I know exactly why I'm here. And that doesn't mean I don't have difficult days, and that doesn't mean that it's easy to achieve my goals all the time. It just means that it's like right path, you know?
Right.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. It's sometimes, I guess this is where, you know, the divine perspiration comes in, because I think there are challenges that come up that, you know, may have a lot to do with our own belief systems. And sometimes, you know, it just has to do with what's going on and around us.
Absolutely. We're impacted on by a lot of things.
Yeah.
A lot of things we're not even conscious of, you know. I mean, it is the school of hard knocks, right? I mean, it, at least for most of us, you know, and certainly most everyone I've ever met, that's really being honest about this life, you know. And, you know, it's like you get into the material, and it's like what you do with the material will really decide the outcome, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you come close to the pain, and do you then step back from the pain because it's just too much and start tripping out and distracting? Or do you find a way to somehow go right into it, really see it through, like a conversion tunnel, see it through to the end of that tunnel, and then some lesson or at least some transformation can start to happen. And there's no question that the lack of education around how to do that is a big, big part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is just a guy on the radio with an idea of something. I mean, I understand how hard it is to figure out how do you actually do that? How do you afford to do that? You know,
yeah.
How do you create space for that in your daily life? How do you shift your consciousness into that place, you know? I mean, I was lucky. I wasn't married and I didn't have kids, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I really devoted myself, you know, and I had a business that allowed me to have some time to go off and do the things that I wanted to do internally. And, And in that place and in those retreat environments, I really had the spaciousness and the lack of pressure on me to really go deep inside of my material, you know?
Yeah.
You know, the question is, how do we set up the world so that more people can do that, you know?
Well, we certainly have to change a lot from where it is right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'd like to start a Soul Shaping University for real, you know, really get some land and do this. And this might happen, and where we can really kind of create an environment, a haven, a safe space for people to come to really get into the gut-wrenching material, to really, really break open, as Elizabeth Lesser says, you know, really break open and see what's on the other side in an environment that's supported with intelligent, you know, grounded, capable practitioners who don't let it go too far when it's not ready to go that far. But, you know, I think that it's important for people to start to let go of the stuff they're holding. I mean, how do you get to a clarified lens on why you're here? I mean, these just become, you know, ideas of something that aren't groundable. If you're loaded up with all kinds of unreleased emotional material, you know, if you armored yourself up, I mean, you got to peel away the armor before true path's going to reveal itself to you.
Yeah.
There's a lot of levels of change that have to happen for this to become an actual way of being and not just some, you know, heightened or kind of floaty concept, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I know when we talk about intentionality, which is down there, you know, that's when we talk about a little bit about our distractions. But, you know, we really, truly distract ourselves most of the time.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
it's uncomfortable. You know, the work is uncomfortable, but I also think, you know, it's very difficult to open to the purest form of vulnerability in such a culture that's vibrating so survivalistically and that is so overwhelming. You know, it's almost like you have to get off the grid sometimes if you like to do this kind of deep work. I did my best work on retreat.
Right.
You know, I did good therapy here. You know, I pieced out stuff, I grounded stuff, but, you know, going away, and I remember I went to a Stan Groff and Jack Kornfield Insight and Opening retreat. And it's just like a cycle. You do meditation, and then you do a breath work. Then you do another day of watching your partner breathe, and then you do more meditation and go into the breath work. And, you know, it was only the second breath work that I had my most... The first breath work is like I opened, and it was like that was a little too far from my urban matrix for me to really fully open to it. And then I needed a few more days to kind of get out of this urban thing and to be there at the governor. I mean, it was called the Governor Dumber Academy. And I really got it. It's like, I'm here to get dumber. I got to get out of my head or if I'm going to do this work, right? And then by the second breath work, which was towards the end of the week, only then was I able to really, really go to the deep place I needed to go, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we distract ourselves with all sorts of things though, like from like all of our addictions.
Yeah.
Are all distraction. I mean, that's become a very big thing that I'm becoming aware of is, you know, how often I distract myself.
And it's so subtle and cool. Like if you really get into the inner soul tracking piece, like how do you do it? You know, it's like, it can be as obvious as a drug problem. It can be, you know, as not so obvious as a tendency to rent videos every night. So you don't have to sit in the back room of your house and sit with your feelings.
Right.
You know, or even more subtly, how do you do it inside of your own physical form? How do you tighten or shallow your breath so you're not breathing deeply into your emotionality?
Mm.
How do you tighten your neck so that you can separate your head and get lost in your thoughts from your physical form and your emotional body, you know?
Mm-hmm.
How do you let your monkey mind get loose? You know, I mean, it's like all of that, and you really have to develop an internal awareness of how you operate as part of this process. Because no one can tell you. I mean, you know, your therapist can tell you have a problem, whatever. It doesn't mean anything. If you don't really glimpse it and really own it, you're not going to be able to shift it too easily.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a kind of an ongoing thing of peeling or understanding is, you know, what do you do to distract yourself?
Yeah.
And I mean, I've known the obvious ones, you know, like friends that keep going to school and, you know, getting more and more degrees. And it's like, wow. That's great, but how is that helping? You know, it's just another form of, you know, putting your mind to something so you can completely distract yourself.
Yeah, I mean, unless what they're doing is really consistent with their true path, then it's probably distractive, you know, or misguided or something like that.
Yeah.
I've been encountering a lot of people lately, and interesting things that absolutely don't want to ever get body work.
Mm.
They don't want to ever be touched. They don't want anyone to peel away the layers of holding to see what lives below. And that's a very interesting way of avoiding our core material, is to avoid physical contact.
Well, and a very sad way, really, because, you know, that's, I mean, of anything in this world, we're so touch deprived.
Yeah, totally are. Yeah.
So to continue that cycle and not realize that that's part of the problem is a bit sad. Okay, soul adventurer.
Yeah, I mean, I really got, for me at least, that what it meant to be a soul shaper really is, I mean, you're not attached to particular tools or techniques. You really jump into experience, you know, and detachment can be part of that. I mean, I'm not really so much into detachment as a way of being, but certainly there are times when one of the adventures, and certainly one that I entertain, was to disconnect from my localized perception identifications, sit back and meditate and try to see myself from a distance. But, you know, more often than not, the way that I worked, it was more like a Sufi probably, which was to jump into experience through my body, you know, to dance or to do intense breath works, to do the insight and opening workshop. Holotropic breath work is fantastic. Bioenergetics, body-centered work is a fantastic way to jump into a felt experience, even a love, profound, intense love-making experience. Anything that helps you to gain more information as to where true path lives inside of you. And to me, that's really the heart of what it means to be a soul shaper. It's to activate and energize and to, you know, look for your answers through the active experience rather than just through conceptual thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of people that have relationship issues and they chat with me and it's like, well, you can't really know what you've healed until you get back into one and, you know, see where your reactions lie. And a lot of people, you know, that terrifies them.
Yeah.
Because they have to be vulnerable. They have to jump in. They have to experience. And that's not always easy.
No. This is a courageous path. You know, I mean, I think a real spiritual path is a courageous path. I mean, you know, jumping into these uncomfortable, I mean, I was into a discomfort. I mean, I was like a discomfort addict almost. You know, I really, really wanted to go places that some part of me was really uncomfortable about, you know. I really wanted to confront my defenses with the possibility that there was nothing to them other than fear, you know. And to have depth charge experiences, you know, to really like, oh, okay, that really scares me, but I can feel like there's something sticky about it, like, there's something in the heart of that resistance that I can, and not all resistance is, you know, sometimes it's a sign that we shouldn't walk down that alley, and that's cool. But it's about making the distinction, you know, and it took some time to figure it out and go, to really understand, like at Harbin Hot Springs, when I didn't want to go wild on that wild barefoot boogie dance floor, you know, with all these half-dressed people, and the whole thing was terrifying to this conservative part of me, you know. But another part knew there was something in that, some place I had to go. And I went there, and there's a Grist for the Mill chapter speaks to it, and it was a profoundly transformative experience for me, you know. And I think that really cuts through the heart of the soul-shaping journey. You know, you boldly go where your soul has not gone before. You really do. You really try to identify that place that's sticky and that's next step, and you just take a shot.
Yeah. Authentically, of course.
Yeah.
Soul tracker.
Yeah, soul tracking is just really about becoming an expert at attuning to the directional signs that as to path that emanate from within you. So it's just, again, just about getting to know what your inner world feels like, you know, what feels like an authentic step, what feels like a false step, you know, really, really subtly getting to know yourself, not listening to what anyone else tells you about you. You know, I mean, even if their intentions are good, they're not going to be able to identify your soul scriptures. Only you are.
Oh, yeah.
And then really, really learning how to find the practices, activities that really allow you, the locations in the world that allow you to feel your insides really deeply, and learning to listen to what direction you have to go next from the scriptures that live inside you, you know. Like making that real, though, not just an idea of something, but really finding enough solitude to get quiet enough inside to figure out where you live inside and to start to follow the tether to that little voice that knows.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And for the people that, you know, have difficulty knowing whether this is ego or soul that's talking, you know, what do you suggest?
I'm not entirely sure that I distinguish the ego and the soul from each other very effectively. I'm not entirely sure that this isn't a bit of an arbitrary distinction that was imported from the East and that isn't in fact true. You know, my ego and soul shape often reflect one another. Okay. And the work that I need to do egoically very often is exactly the work that I need to do to expand spiritually. So, you know, if we're talking about ego as in a false sense of self, and if we're talking about the soul, for example, as authentic sense of self, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that that's an important distinction to be made. But in terms of the healthy ego and the soul's journey, I mean, this is probably a topic for another day, but this is what I had talked to Ram Dass about in January, and he had taken some responsibility. He felt that he had brought this notion, this one-sided notion of soul versus ego, this dichotomy back from the East, and he was kind of up against this false ego thing that was happening in Western culture. So it ends up a little bit misguided, I think, because I think there's a point at which they actually work to support one another. You know, if the ego is doing the work to support the soul's true path, then the ego is a good thing.
Definitely.
You know, we need a healthy functioning ego. You know, Westerners are not crazy to say a healthy self-concept goes a long way in terms of our own expansion. If you don't feel strong enough or good enough about yourself, I don't think you're going to take yourself seriously enough to do this work. I don't think you're going to be able to fall apart enough on the path, which is part of the process of reassembly to expand yourself. So it depends really, I think, what you mean when you talk about ego.
Very fair. I think, you know, I think you're right in that we have given the ego a very bad name.
Yeah.
And, you know, the only way we can work with the ego is to learn to embrace it and love it. And that allows it to sort of transform into that healthy ego that you're chatting about, which, you know, I don't know that a lot of people understand that, but.
Well, these are pretty subtle distinctions. I mean, the way that it worked for me before I had language even to begin to grapple with this was I used to get these chills, like truth chills, like these chills of truth, that feeling almost like goosebumps on my soul skin whenever like I was choosing to do something or responding to something in a way that was supportive of my true path, you know, and when I didn't get that feeling, then I knew that it was coming from some misguided place, whether it was egoic or, you know, somebody else's ideas of something that I had imported internally. You know, I think what you really got to keep going for is that little feeling inside of you, which grows stronger over time, that you're moving in the right direction. Just like an aha moment, maybe not quite that strong, maybe just a more subtle sense of comfort in your own skin. When you end a relationship, for example, that isn't serving you, you know, you just know on the deeper level, there's like a breath. You get a broader, more spacious breath starts to happen, you know? I think that's what you just keep going for, because that's probably where your soul lives, you know? And then you don't have to get so much into the languaging of ego versus soul and all that.
Yeah, I do think we spend too much time in our head, so languaging is probably part of the problem, isn't it?
Yeah, sometimes it is, yeah.
And our definitions of our language is the other part.
Yeah, language can be very confining. It can also be liberating. I mean, one of the things I'm trying to do with this Soul Shaping Dictionary, I think, is to try to upframe language so it becomes more positive. You know, like nervous breakdown, which is a downer, versus nervous breakthrough, which makes you feel like you're actually getting somewhere, you know?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are ways to work with language that take us higher, you know, like the way Jean Houston always wrote, which was really to take it and re- and upframe it so that it became something that actually ignited our spiritual journey rather than deflected from it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we need a lot of that, or a lot more of that. It's good. So you're doing a good thing. Yeah, I know you needed my confirmation there. I think we talked about intentionality. How about the body garden?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it became clear to me that throughout my own journey, my inclination was to do most of my journey through my body. You know, my body was the karmic field where my spiritual lessons were harvested. And, you know, for me, repressed emotions, they were really primarily unactualized spiritual lessons. Every time I was able to go deeper and deeper into these feelings I was resistant to feeling, I seemed to expand spiritually, you know? And it always seemed to happen through my body. I mean, I had like kind of conceptual moments of realization in my mind, but most often it emanated from a physical experience in my body. So, but that's me, you know, it's like sitting and meditating didn't so much do it for me. I needed to move my body and move my energy and move and clear my holdings before I became naturally meditative.
Right.
So I always needed to activate the body in order to get clear and more authentic. And so that's what body garden means. It really means that the soul shaper tills the soul soil with purifying practices. And the examples, enlivening exercises, armor busters, heart openers, in an effort to create space inside for true path to emerge. And the idea is a built-in authenticity monitor. The body dulls when it's living falsely, and it glows when it's true to path. This is a particular embodied view of spirituality that isn't shared by everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there are a lot of more head-centered, top-down views of spirituality, but mine is really a ground-up model that starts with the body and clearing the body and then moving higher to a more complete spiritual experience.
And for most of us, and I would say most of us, we have to do it through the body. We definitely can't do it through the mind. And, you know, whether it's our heart or whether it's our solar plexus or whatever, you know, wherever we sort of connect deepest with, I mean, we really have to get in touch with those aspects of self.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, it's not everyone's path. And, you know, I mean, I'm a heart guy. You know, it always comes through my heart if it gets me anywhere. But there are others who really, really do a lot. I have a friend who does a lot of work through the mind, you know, is not so enheartened, is not really so open-hearted, much more kind of rational person than I am, probably, but really does seem to make real progress on a spiritual path, you know.
Through the mind.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
And unusual for most of the people that I've connected with.
Yeah.
But, it is very true when I connect with other people that are from the heart or other people that are from the solar plexus. I mean, you can really feel the differences when people relate to different areas in how they connect with people and how they evolve.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Hmm. Yeah, and it's, you got to be, you know, I'm careful not to judge it, you know. I mean, I think we have to be wary of the spiritual bypass. We have to be wary that we're not participating in practices as a way of getting away from our discomfort on the earth plane.
Distracting us? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the spiritual bypass. You know, Robert Masters is going to have a book out soon, I think, with North Atlantic, all about the spiritual bypass. And, you know, I have a bit about it in Soul Shaping, but I think it's a really important thing to talk about. And again, it comes back to intentionality. It's like, why are you meditating? You know, why are you doing anything that you call spiritual, you know? Are you doing it to get more connected to yourself on an authentic level, or are you doing it to get away from your discomfort on the earth plane? Not to say sometimes you don't have to get away, but at some point you got to come back down and get to work here, because this is where it's at, here, in your body, on this planet, on Mother Earth. And, you know, so I think you just, it's all about intentionality, and really be careful about the bypass. Really come back to this question, which is, why am I engaging in this practice? Not just like, what is the practice? Not like, how do I do the practice better? But like, why am I doing it? You know, where am I trying to get to? Where am I trying to get away from? You know, these are important questions. I went through a phase when I was meditating a lot, and this is just me, but I really felt like I was doing it to get out of here. And that wasn't serving me so much. But when I did these retreats, like Insight and Opening, where I really moved stuff like holdings and rage out of my body, then when I sat down to meditate, I really felt like my intention was a lot cleaner. I wasn't trying to get away from all this discomfort I was holding. I wasn't feeling so much discomfort anymore. And then I could really settle into a nice organic meditative state. And the intention felt like it was like to take me to the next place in my journey. It's very different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's, you know, really great questions to be asking ourselves, because I think that would enlighten us more on, you know, why we are doing things. Because I think you're right. I think I'd never even thought of that. But I think that that's a good thing that we do with regards to meditation.
With regards to everything, like why am I here? You know, what is this why? You know, is this true to my ultimate path? Is this my intending? Am I trying to have an experience of something deeper and more authentic? Hmm. Or am I trying to disengage?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Thoughts? School of Heart Knocks, we sort of already talked about it. Is there anything more there that...
No, I think we, you know, it's just this idea that karma yoga kind of meets therapeutic process, that you're working your material, you're working your lessons, you're learning them, you're actualizing those lessons through the work that you're doing on an emotional level, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you have a relationship, it's very difficult, and then it's like processing, working through that material so that you can ultimately figure out what the lesson was. I mean, if you can see it all the way through to the end, really, really honor it, and really learn from it, then that's how karma yoga, that's how the expanding or stretching of the soul happens in the heart of our emotional healing.
Hmm.
Yeah.
God is in the people.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, it was sort of a reaction to some of the detachment models, again, that are out there, that this idea that soul shaping is an immersion model as opposed to a detachment model. It's about jumping into life, immersing ourselves in our feelings and our experiences in order to learn what we need to expand our soul's consciousness. It's about feeling God, not thinking God, you know?
Yeah.
And that's, I think we've pretty much covered that, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Be real now.
Be real now is just this, obviously a reaction or a reframe of be here now. It's really soul shaping. You know, didn't know throughout my journey what was I trying to say, apart from reciting my own journey, what was really my core philosophy. And I think the term that really stuck to me, and took a long time, it took being in the presence of Ram Dass during an interview for this doc that I'm making to really understand what I meant by it. And the term was ascending with both feet on the ground. And I really, really was uncomfortable with this notion of enlightenment, light, like it was some kind of bliss train thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, again, I had this belief that the work that I was doing in uncovering my soul's journey and healing my heart was, I was just trying to get back to this stage that I had been at very early in my life before a lot of the trauma, when I just felt like I was available to everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was really in the moment. I was really like, I was, you know, earth and sky, localized lens, archetypal waves, subtle and gross realms, everything happening at the same time. And so be real now really connects to this term enrealment.
Mm-hmm.
And really, as opposed to enlightenment, really the idea that what we're doing here, and I think this is somewhat consistent with Ken Wilber's work, is to try to get into a place like a more inclusive state, where like you're in all places at one time, rather than just in the most comfortable places. So, you know, if your friend passes away, you're unhappy.
Yeah.
And that's not, you know, a substandard state. That's considered to be a completely authentic and appropriate state in that circumstance. In other words, you're available emotionally for everything again, rather than just the things that don't feel triggering and that feel the most comfortable.
Right.
Yeah.
And you talk about the shadow and the light. And it's really important that we look at our shadows and not, you know, I've recently been reading somebody who, you know, the shadow part of us is our strength, and we need it to be the, you know, the part of us that works through our life.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's where we do a lot of the work, you know, and it's, I mean, if we can really see it through, you know, apart from the lessons that come through and all the rest of it, I'm, you know, at the end of a very, very foul and difficult stage, quite often I end up feeling fantastic. Like I was doing some kind of shadowy work, not always obvious, not always easy to articulate, but there was something in that dark place that had to happen to bring me along to the next place in my journey. And, you know, if we don't have that experience, it's just going to be a concept. And, you know, one of the problems, and I think this relates to survivalism in the world, is that for so many people, you know, they are discouraged from being negative. You know, they're encouraged to put on a happy face. They're encouraged to stay positive and in their focus. They're encouraged to believe that they just ask the universe for what they want and they're going to get it.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to a very difficult idea for most of us, which is that we really, really submerge into these negative places. Now, you can't go too far. Some of us go into a place that's so depressed and so difficult that we can't get out of it. So you have to be careful, and I think therapeutic support is very important if you're going to do a lot of very prolonged shadow work. But, you know, I think that my greatest creative moments seem to emerge after bouts of sort of dark and difficult phases in my life.
Hmm. You know? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Elizabeth Lesser writes about it beautifully in Broken Open. You know, you really get the connection between a willingness to submerge and then the tendency to emerge afterwards.
Your wording is great. A soul-to-soul philosophy, S-O-L-E to S-O-U-L.
Yeah, again, back to this idea of ascending. I mean, I think I'm saying the same thing in a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just really this idea that our ascension to the God Self can only be sustained if it's an embodied unfolding from the ground up. So we begin with the root chakra and we work our way up. So, you know, it's like starting on Mother Earth. You know, instead of a top-down model, which is you have like a, you know, we've all had these in relationships, these sky experiences, these like, whoa, we're like with God experiences, and then we have no roots on Mother Earth and the whole thing falls apart. It's unsustainable. Mm-hmm. So it's like the opposite of that. It's like really working the practical realms into your notion of spirituality. Not just tripping out in a cave, but really doing it in the heart of your life, you know, working your material, seeing what triggers you have at each stage, at each chakra along the way, learning to work that material, healing that part of your emotional body, and then finding that you start to move higher, but in a very natural and inclusive way, not as a bypass. Not to get away from something uncomfortable, but in a way as a celebration of it. You know, you go to the next stage and you're celebrating all the work you've done along the way.
I like that.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit more difficult. I mean, this idea that we're going to come to something called enlightenment by getting out of here is really attractive, particularly, you know, if our life has been difficult or if the cultural circumstances are very difficult. You know, and I think we can get a lot of comfort, or we can have a wonderful break from the discomfort of Mother Earth that way. But I think if we really want to have a sustainable way of being that really has the kind of the quality of a sturdy spirituality, we have to get our legs and our feet strong. We have to really feel our feet. And then we have to feel each chakra all the way up until we reach this more heightened place and we're really, really solid below, you know? And then we can stick around for life instead of having to leave every time something's triggered.
Mm.
Yeah.
Which we do, and we don't realize.
Yeah, it's tempting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think we just don't realize it.
Yeah.
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 Honoring the UBS.
Well, the UBS is just, I call the Universal Broadcasting System, which I've defined as, I'll just read it, the dynamic and benevolent network of relatedness that brings lessons and messengers onto our path in an ongoing effort to grow our soul. So honoring the UBS for me means understanding that it's not a simple, the UBS responds to authentic transformation. It is attuned to our soulular state. And what I mean by that is it's attuned to how close or how far we are from honoring our true path in this lifetime. So we get, you know, whatever we ask for, maybe we get it, maybe we don't get it, but what we will get is what the universe knows we need in order to accelerate our journey. And that may be a very uncomfortable and difficult lesson. It may be a wake-down call that we didn't think we were prepared for. You know, it could be any one of a number of things, but it's really understanding that there is something benevolent out there and that we have to work with it and that it's responsive to where we really are in our journeys. Not where we want to be in our journeys, but where we really are. So like you may ask the universe to give you a Rolls Royce. You may get one, you know, but you may smash it into a highway pylon 2 days later because the lesson you really needed from that Rolls Royce was something other than what you thought.
Mm.
Yeah, I don't think the universe responds to wishful thinking. I think it responds to, you know, has an authentic sense of where we're at and where we need to go, and it moves from that place.
Yeah, well, I'm always a little weary of people that want a Rolls Royce for so many reasons, but,
yeah.
You know.
Well, definitions of our abundance are a whole other question.
Yeah. And whether it comes from our soul or our negative ego.
Yeah.
Soul success.
Yeah, just, you know, it became clear to me along the way that certainly in leaving law and walking away from that path that I was making a distinction on some level between egoic and, you know, say, negative egoic and soulful notions of achievement. And that for a soul shaper, what success is learning the lesson, honoring their innate image, their true path. And that could mean leaving 8 or 10 careers along the way, learning a little lesson along the way, being in a relationship that's a very important relationship because it teaches us something we need so we can be more complete, and then accepting that and moving forward, moving to the next connection or relationship that will serve us. And, you know, this is a very, you know, the way survivalist structures work, this is a very uncomfortable thing for them because the survivalist structure really wants people to be doing the same thing for 40 years, you know. But I think when you get into this perspective or this way of being, you begin to understand that it doesn't, things aren't going to look the way that you were taught they were going to look, you know. I mean, I was taught that I was going to be a poor Jew, and then I was going to, if I was real lucky, get into law school, and then I was going to become a lawyer, and I was never going to look back. And it didn't happen like that, you know. And it's a good thing that it didn't happen like that now, but... You know, it really is, and what ended up happening is some other idea of success or advancement emerged for me, which was completely and directly linked to what it meant for me to grow.
Right.
Just grow, and growing has a whole other contour and texture than a more egoic notion of success.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I said in the book, flake it till you make it. Not to glorify, you know, the flaking it, the way of flaking it when we're really not moving anywhere, because that sometimes is happening. We're just not really in anything. But it's just the idea that it's okay to keep jumping around a little if you're really learning something along the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you are.
If you are.
If you are.
Hmm. Only soul knows.
Yeah, only soul knows really just basically means that you're the only one who knows what your path is. And, you know, some guru may call out to your knowing, or, you know, your father may tell you what he thinks is best for you, and he might in fact be right. But really, you have to come back to tracking your own internal journey and validating and honoring it and moving from that place outward. That only you can know your soul scriptures. You came in with whatever particular path is encoded in you, whatever divine purpose, and you're the only one who can delineate, define what that is.
You make an interesting point about always giving others back their own power.
Yeah, it's important to me, you know, because I've learned this over the course of the last year, that there's a lot of projection onto the spirit writer or onto this one or onto this. There's just so much projection. And I used to project on Eddie Greenspan, and I projected onto Ram Dass, and I projected on, you know, I just think it's really important for those of us who are doing this work, trying to help humanity in this way, to understand that we don't know so much, you know. I mean, these are just some ideas, and hopefully they remind someone of something inside of them, but they're the only ones who can decide it. And at the end of the day, to be careful not to get too full of ourselves, you know, and to really give it back to the other person. Make the presumption of essence in people you encounter. See them in their highest light, you know, and really understand that you don't really know what direction they're supposed to walk. It's tempting. You know, sometimes people ask me, and I feel like there's this part of me that wants to say, I know who you are, and I know why you're here, and this is what you have to do next. And I do it sometimes. I catch myself doing it. But really, you know, I think at the end of the day, we have to come back to the record. And sometimes you do it because, you know, they want to hear that so bad. They want someone to know so they can, like, take a break from having to figure it out for a while.
Yeah.
But I think it's, at the end of the day, trying to recognize, really, that we don't know. You know. Only the particular individual can know, and to empower them to believe that again, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. Inchworms.
Inchworms. Just the idea that it takes time, you know. You know,
yeah.
So many people write me or talk to me about, feel like, you know, they say, how long is this going to take? And I say, how long is what going to take? How long is it going to take until I'm there? And I'm not entirely sure what they mean by there. If they mean Brahman or like completeness or wholeness, it's going to be a long time. So it's like really getting that this journey is, this is it. It isn't really, you know, it's trite to say, but it really isn't about the destination. Yeah, you want to reach plateaus where you're more comfortable in your own body. But, you know, really, you have to understand that this is a soul to soul. This is like one lifetime after another. This isn't your only shot at it. And if you believe that, and I think it, and I do believe that, then I think you can kind of let go a little of the idea that you've got to work it all out this time. Mm. And just allow yourself to just breathe into the process. You know, like, it's fine to be willful, and it's fine to make it a priority, but you are not going to work through and integrate all of your material in a 12-month period. It is not going to happen.
Well, that's the problem.
It ain't going to happen. Yeah, it's just not going to happen.
Gender bridge.
Gender bridge is just simply the idea that not to get too over-identified with gender. It's just a way station, an opportunity for the soul to embody particular archetypes and work through its karmic lessons. You know, and so it was for me to really understand with relation to my warrior in particular, that my warrior was, you know, I was so identified with my male warrior. Like, we're so identified with so many of these things. And it was really to understand that it was just a vehicle and not the end point. And to see gender, or to see my gender attachment to that through a broader archetypal lens, like that I was warrior because I needed warrior in this lifetime in order to become soul shaper, for example.
Right.
You know, but not to see that male edgy being as somehow anything more than an archetypal figure. You know, that was some way of being that was allowing me to become a more inclusive experience, you know, to become some ultimate mix of assertiveness and receptivity. You know, I mean, really, ultimately, for me, the ultimate experience is almost genderless on a cellular level. Like, you become some being who really isn't particularly identified with any of that stuff anymore.
Right.
Yeah, so they're just like foot soldiers that help you to get to that place.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Soul pod seeking.
Yeah, it's just understanding the importance of soul pod. Your soul pod are those individuals or groups of people who your soul finds resonance with at any given moment. So I think it's very important for us to understand that as we can grow forward on our spiritual path, we begin to identify with different people, perhaps, than we've identified with before. We begin to shed other connections, and to understand that that's part of the process. It's really okay. And to keep looking, to keep searching and being open to individuals that are resonant with who we've become at each stage along the way. You know, so like my family, parts of my biological family were my initial soul pod. Lessons were to be learned there. But at some point along the way, it was important to understand that that's really not where my fundamental lessons were happening anymore. And that it was okay. I didn't have to feel guilty about that. Yeah.
And you talk about forgiveness here.
Right. Yeah. I'll just read it. I think it's easier somehow. The soul shaper honors those souls that established the foundation for her to go higher, those souls who died on battlefields so she could live, those souls who did anything positive to light her way. At the same time, she does not bypass her feelings or forgive the past arbitrarily, but only when that forgiveness is an organic manifestation of a genuine emotional resolution. This is really a response to how many, so many of us get into a place of sort of arbitrary or premature forgiveness with people in our lives, and it's about honoring what the other has brought, but at the same time honoring ourselves and allowing ourselves to go through an organic process of forgiveness, to get to an organic forgiveness at the end of the, the end of the day.
Yeah. Well, you know, as much as we can pretend we might be forgiving somebody, it, you know, we don't truly forgive somebody until we do go through the whole process.
Yeah, it's not authentic.
No.
You know, you say I forgive them, but your eyes are filled with rage. I've been there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I did that for a long time, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's about understanding your soul pod. You know, you're not always going to come out of it at the end of the day with everyone that's been part of your pod and feel so fantastic and positive about them. And that's okay. You know,
yeah.
Not always supposed to.
What happens to love and compassion, though, for all beings?
I don't know. It's a good question.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's the ultimate goal for humanity, but I think the only way we're going to get there is organically.
Right.
And authentically, and I mean, I think that's it. I mean, that's the world as it ought to be, but I'm living in the world as it is, and if I'm going to get the bridge from the world as it is to the world as it ought to be is authenticity.
Yeah.
It's just telling the truth. You know, it's just that I have, you know, it's like holding up a vision of how I'm supposed to operate in the world 8 generations from now as a being is not going to serve me, you know, right now. I mean, I've got to get there somehow.
Right.
you know, and I think that's where we're stuck a little. These kind of cheesy, you know, very quick fix ideas of how we should operate interactively or spiritually, you know, they're hollow at the end of the day. They're not getting us where we want to go. We really got to be willing to really, really develop an awareness that's subtle and painstakingly subtle and really, really focused on what we're up to internally. You know, what are we really feeling? How can we really express these feelings to get through to the next place, rather than just putting it all away and smiling and saying that we forgive them because forgiveness is the ultimate spiritual path? I don't think that's getting us anywhere.
Hmm.
You know, it's got to be real.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it isn't important, but it's just like, how do you get there is even more important.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, the last one is gift back.
Yeah, gift back was just this idea, and this happened to me, that like after I had done at least enough work, I began to feel this organic need to give these learnings or, you know, something back to humanity. It's this idea that we're so inextricably linked, and that at some point along the way, we do the work and then we begin to look for ways to gift back to the universe that gifted us with this precious life. And, you know, it's just a recognition of the interlinked nature of the human experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to give is the only way we can receive.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, Jeff, always, always, always a pleasure. I'm sure we'll have you back. I'm sure there's more things that you will come up with that that Intuitive Soul Radio would love to have you back for.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been great.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
All right, we will be back on Thursday with the last interview, so for the season. So look forward to seeing you then.